Section 5, speed her up, 4-1.
I'm Mark Levin, and welcome to Action Speaks Underappreciated 20th Century Dates That Changed America. Produced by AS220 with help from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities. Our presenting radio station is WGBH Boston, and we're online at actionspeaksradio.org. The theme for our 2012 season is private rights and public fights, or how individual rights and the expectations they create often seem in conflict with the needs of the public or with an older concept currently being revived, the commons. We're taping from the cafe at AS220 in Down City, Providence, Rhode Island. Today, our topic is the 1936 release of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, when Chaplin's tramp is swallowed by the assembly line. It inadvertently marches with the Union and ultimately falls in love with a beautiful orphan, Paulette Goddard. Join us today on Action Speaks to see what Chaplin has shown us about our modern times, both then and now. And with us today to help us unpack the issues in this great, almost silent classic, and to help us identify its contemporary ramifications are Charles Musser, professor of film and American studies at Yale University and the author of The Emergence of Cinema, The American Screen to 1907. Maureen Reddy, chair of the English department of Rhode Island College and the author of Traces, Codes, and Clues, Reading Race and Crime Fiction, and Phil Rosen, professor of modern culture and media at Brown University. His most recent book is Change Mummified Cinema, Historicity, Theory. Welcome to Action Speaks. So, Charles Musser, give us the beginnings, since we're starting the beginning of the show, give us the beginnings of Chaplin's Modern Times, if you would.
Well, you know, the film opens with a shot of a clock, and this immediately brings us back to lots of Chaplin's earlier work. The clock is really a central piece in many of his films. It's time and industrial time and the discipline of the workplace is something that in some ways is represented by the clock. I mean, the clock is more complicated than that, but that's so that opening shot means a lot to his audience. And then it begins with a silent intertitle, which is, I think, also to remind us that this film is still working within the silent film genre with some modifications, but not as radical as it might first appear. And that title goes, "A Story of Industry, of Individual Enterprise, Humanity Crusading in Pursuit of Happiness." And then we move to live action, and we see sheep being led basically to the slaughter. And that dissolves into a shot of men coming out of the subway and going to work and going into the factory where we will discover Charlie Chaplin. So there's a way in which the assembly line, which actually originated in the slaughterhouses of Chicago, is then transformed into the assembly line for the production of cars at Ford and elsewhere.
I would agree. I would emphasize something that Charlie said, which is that beginning with the clock is all about mechanization, because what the clock gives us is a kind of accountable time, which was used to discipline labor, to to pay labor, the whole idea of wage labor, that is paying by the hour. So even when Charlie has gone crazy, the one thing he doesn't forget is to punch out of the factory, right? And then when he runs out on the street, and then he comes back, he runs back in before he's going to be sent to the insane asylum, he punches in, but then the cards go everywhere. He kind of makes chaos of the system.
Maureen, I know that you work a lot with 19th century, and the great British historian E.P. Thompson wrote a wonderful essay on time and on how time began to structure the way in which people really scheduled their lives. And like you said, it was no longer a work day that was composed of light and darkness, but it was something much more incremental.
Right, and it was no longer, obviously, then in accord with any sort of natural diurnal rhythm. And one of the things that I find most striking about this film is the way in which it connects with much earlier critiques of industrialization, thematically, visually, etc. It has a lot in common with many 19th century industrial novels, actually.
I like the way you were talking, Phil, about the chaos that was Chaplin. In some ways, it's almost like Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss made anarchy okay for kids, and Chaplin seems to make anarchy okay for the working class in some way or another.
Yeah, but what I would say is that that one of the striking things about modern time is that the tramp character, who started off, you know, with Max Sennett in the teens, and people grew up with this character, at that time was could be a pretty nasty character, kind of a lech. You know, willing to pull all sorts of kinds of tricks on people. He was very, very kind of mischievous. And as the 20s went on, it kind of deepened and became more poignant, right? And what happens when you get to modern times is there's a certain way in which the tramp wants a kind of a middle-class normalcy. There are these, you know, wants a close relation, a close heterosexual relationship, wants the house in the country, you know, and so forth, and can't get it. But what happens is that his body keeps on getting in the way. His body keeps on getting in the way. So when the machine drives him crazy, his body is twitching all over the place as he kind of apes the mechanical motion he had to make at the machine. When he's in prison, he becomes a hero essentially because he takes what they call nose powder. Okay, but also there's that peculiar scene with the paragons of middle class gentility, which are the minister and his wife. And Chaplin has, as a privileged prisoner, has tea with the minister's wife. And Chaplin uses the soundtrack to give us the grumbles and the growls of the stomach. Again, it's the body can't quite fit into all of these normal places where he would like to be. He lifts the teacup in a very genteel way. But then their stomachs start growling, and it becomes kind of impossible. They try to ignore their bodies. And so, how bodies make resistances, how bodies don't fit into the discipline, seems to me to be a very interesting kind of theme in this film.
And I want to get into this a little later, the way in which industrial civilization is a totalizing culture. It not only affects the way people think, it affects how they live physically in their souls, in their minds, and how their bodies begin to be disciplined to behave in a certain way. Yeah, Maureen?
There are two moments very early in the film that seem to underscore this. One is the really striking use of surveillance by the big boss, who is watching even in the bathrooms, which I think is really interesting. His face comes up on the cameras, even in the bathrooms. And the other one is when the Chaplin character actually gets fed through the gears of the machine. And it's when he pops out that the police drag him off to the insane asylum.
Let's talk a little bit about who Charlie Chaplin was when this film was made and how it fits in the context of his work.
Well, he hadn't made a film for 5 years, or he hadn't released a film for 5 years. And I think there was actually a lot of question about if he wasn't going to be over the hill, if he wasn't like the people who he started United Artists with, that is Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, D.W. Griffith, all of whom in the previous few years had sort of gone from being superstars to being basically out of the industry and unemployed. And so there was real thought that this might happen to Chaplin. And I think people were delighted with the film when it first came out. And the film got a huge, very positive reception. Broke box office records and all sorts of things. And so, you know, you might initially think that means that this film was not a forgotten date. But actually, by the time the Academy Awards happened, it wasn't nominated for a single Academy Award. So, and I think in part because what happened, which was that between when this film was released and the Academy Awards, you know, less than about a year later, The automobile unions had been formed at Ford and General Motors, and things were very different. And if you will, the kind of labor unrest that was at the heart of this film had transformed the way labor was organized.
So this is 1936.
Yeah,
Phil.
I think that's a very important point. Is that this is just when a New Deal measures that enabled unions to organize. It was the period of sit-down strikes, you know. It was the period people were still being killed who went out on strike. There was tremendous struggle, union struggles going on. So the stuff about union, I mean, it's really kind of ripped right from the headlines. So it's a very, very current, contemporary kind of thing.
We're talking about one of the great, probably the greatest actor, director, filmmaker, really, in the history of cinema. Am I right at this point, Charles?
Oh, at this point, yes. I mean, you know, of course, you could have arguments about Orson Welles as another director.
But by 1936, it's Chaplin still.
Yeah, Chaplin. Chaplin has been was often considered the first great film artist. Widely acknowledged by 1915, and this is 20 years later, and he reasserts that with his film.
And by this time, he has his own studio. He's making tons of money. He came over in around 1915, 1916 with almost like an English vaudeville troupe and gets hooked up with Mack Sennett. Am I right?
Well, he joins the film industry, or Mack Sennett, in 1913, which is the same year that the assembly line is started at the Ford Motor Company. I think that those two things come together in this film in particular. Chaplin went and visited Ford's assembly lines in 1923. And if you look at this photograph that was taken of Henry Ford, Edsel Ford, and Charlie Chaplin in the background, you'll see that the industrial machinery that appears in modern times is totally evokes that photograph. So I think that this actually, Modern Times, is a film specifically about Detroit. I mean, it's interesting, it's a film about Detroit, and yet it's also every city, every industrial place. There's a kind of tension between the specific and the universal. And the kinds of things he's experiencing in this factory are very much what workers were experiencing in Detroit and in the Ford Motor Company. So if you talk about the speed up of the line, which happens in this in Modern Times, this is exactly what Henry Ford was doing. He was secretly increasing the speed of the line just a little bit every day to get more work out of his employees. And also he didn't have this kind of TV modernist surveillance system, but he did have secret sort of goons who would sort of always be every place. And probably, if you went into the bathroom and took a smoke, you know, one of them would be hiding in the toilet and, like, you know, report you. So I mean, these are the kinds of people recognized that this film was speaking to a very specific time and place.
Charlie Chaplin, following his 1931-32 world tour. The trail is nearly over, and I'm returning to Hollywood. Looking back on my holidays leaves me with an outstanding impression. Europe and the different countries I visited, embroiled in unrest, seem brewing a new epoch, theistic, sociological, and economical, unprecedented in the history of civilization. It animates me with a desire for accomplishment, not in the old way, but in something new, perhaps in another field of endeavor.
Stalling, get back to work.
I'm Mark Levitt, and today on Action Speaks, we're talking about the 1936 release of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times as he joined the millions of uprooted Americans in a search for happiness and a sense of place. With us today are Charles Musser, professor of film and American studies at Yale University and the author of The Emergence of Cinema, The American Screen to 1907. Maureen Reddy, chair of the English department of Rhode Island College and the author of Traces, Codes, and Clues, Reading Race and Crime Fiction, and Philip Rosen, a Brown University professor of modern culture and media, where he studies film theory, history, media, theories of culture, and ideology, as well as theories of history. Welcome back. When we left, I read a quote by Charlie Chaplin. And in this quote, he talks about a 16-month tour that he took around the world. And when he came back, armed with all these impressions of the Great Depression, armed with these ideas that were fermenting around through the various people that he met at the time, he, as an artist, wanted to create something new. He wasn't content with doing the same thing over and over again. Am I right to read it that way?
I think that's right. And one of the indicators of that is how long he was now taking between films. He had his own studio, which was essentially a piece of real estate that was dead a lot of the times, unless he could rent it out. He had his own crew and his own people. But as Charlie was saying, it's been 5 years since his previous film. This is from somebody who 20 years before had been cranking out one short a week, okay? And in doing that, became the most famous film star in the world, by the way. So it was clear that from now on, whenever he made a film, he would have a specific reason and purpose for it.
Yeah. So he evolved as an artist. He didn't take this work as a, quote, clown lightly. Am I right?
Absolutely. It was on his trip across the country to the opening of City Lights in New York that he really felt that he had encountered the Depression in a kind of new and serious way, meeting ordinary people. And I think that, you know, when you make films the way he was undoubtedly making City Lights, the way he made films, that was like all of his working time, you know, from when he woke up to when he went to bed very late at night. And so in some ways, in the midst of making finishing City Lights, he was sort of immune from the Depression and what was happening outside the world. And so he re-encountered it on his way to open that film, and then he went right around the world. But I think that what he encountered in the United States was something he kept thinking about during the rest of his voyage.
And was there many films about working people and many novels that you've run across that actually dealt with the issues that working people were struggling with?
Let me talk about novels maybe rather than films briefly. There was an attempt to talk about the conditions of life for working class people going back, you know, to the early part of the 19th century, but it's usually middle class people writing about working class people, and very often the working class people aren't at the center. The most striking parallel I see is in the one, to my mind, truly great 19th century working class novel, Mary Barton, by Elizabeth Gaskell, which actually in so many ways connects with this film, including the ending. The ending of that novel, it's clear that there's no way to imagine working class people being happy within an industrial society. So Gaskell sends them off from England to Canada. And at the end of this film, which I realize I read far more negatively than anybody else on the panel, but the end of this film is outside that urban space, or at least mostly outside that urban space, where we see them going somewhere else. The else doesn't get defined. But I think it's a really interesting comment on mechanization, urbanization, industrialization. How can we live there? And the answer is, well, we can't.
Please.
Yeah, I think increasingly in his career, Chaplin's Little Tramp was maybe the most beloved popular single character in the world since about 1914-15. But in the 20s, as he began making feature films, starting with The Kid in 1919, as the films got further and further apart, certain aspects of that tramp character, right, which aligned him with what we now call, depending on which week, either the 99% or the 47% or the 30%. But he gets aligned with them, but not as a member of a working class exactly, but as a kind of a lonely vagrant who's always trying to find ways to get along in the world. He's impoverished, but he wants to maintain be genteel. But somehow is always a bit of an outsider, and so doesn't quite fit in as a communist or as a union person, right?
Gentility doesn't work in the age of automation and factories, and he's betwixt and between as a character. Maureen?
I think one of the great moments of this film where that outsider position gets marked is during the bucolic fantasy with Godard, where it's imagined that they have a little home, etc. And the Chaplin comment on it, which I think is brilliant, is, "We'll get a home even if I have to work for it."
Well, in a way, Chaplin did see these characters as people who were living outside of the, quote, system. And he sort of valorized that. And it was something that was obviously difficult to do, and yet he romanticized it and understood the richness that that experience offered outside of factory life.
But I think part of the key is that the character keeps on wanting to try to find ways to get into the system. And these are imaginary ways, utopian. And again, something keeps on getting in the way. And sometimes, you know, often his body or a strike or inadvertently picking up a red flag. But he sets out to try to get in, and the system won't let him in.
In the case where he's fantasizing about having food, having a home, where he's in a Los Angeles, essentially a Los Angeles 1920s suburb, and he watches the husband and wife come out, and the wife says goodbye in this kind of classic I Love Lucy sort of way and kisses and dances back in, he does a mimic dance, pretending to be that housewife that says goodbye to the husband. And in a way, as he's doing that, he's both wanting to be part of it as well as scoffing at it. And of course, the thing that stops his fantasy is the cop that comes and says, you can't sit here anymore. Marie.
Well, significantly, I mean, I hope we're going to talk more about gender, but he dances the woman's part there. And there's another great scene, I mean, where he steals lunch in a cafeteria that's for ladies only. So a kind of double transgression. There are some great gender bending and playing with moments.
I think that's interesting, Charlie. I want to talk about that, actually, because of his movements. Nijinsky called him a ballet dancer. And many people look at some of the gestures and the behavior, and they read into it a lot of gender, quote, confusion, and wondered whether he's male, female, acting out. What is he doing playing with these various gender roles?
But he was small, and I think that he actually not only is relatively small in stature, but he chooses actually very large actors often to put himself against them so that the discrepancy is even greater. And of course, you know, in general, women are a little shorter than men. So I think that that right from there, he does see himself as identifying with the feminine. So, yeah.
And the poetics of his movement are wonderful and yet, you know, evocative of sort of a transgender kind of relationship to rather than the sort of the poles of male and female.
It may be of interest, just as a sidelight, that, and I can't remember the year, but he made a short called, I think it was A Woman, in which he played the whole film in drag.
But, the other thing to say about Chaplin is his romances with women were well known and often considered quite scandalous. So I mean, you know, his heterosexuality.
Was firmly established.
But I think that it's important to, you know, to put these things all together. There might have been other actors, other silent comedians for whom the situation was maybe more complicated.
A question from the audience, name and where you're from.
Yeah, Bert from Providence. Maureen, referencing the comment you made about the sort of no escape or not envisioning a future outside of this trap, if you will, reminded me of something my father, you know, Italian immigrant, factory worker, World War II guy, me coming home from work, being at the dinner table and complaining about my job, and my father getting so frustrated and pounding the table saying, what makes you think you're supposed to enjoy your work? So I'm just wondering how pervasive this sort of, or how much resignation there was to this in the culture, and what were the broader implications of all this?
Maureen?
Yeah, I think that that's part of the discipline, Bert. I think that one way that bodies get disciplined is disciplined into accepting these conditions as normal, to learn to be grateful for your job. So we have the scene where the factory owner is introducing a feeding machine, because then you don't even have to take lunch breaks. The food is literally being shoved down the throat of the character, and I think that's part of that discipline. Yeah. We own you. We own your body. You know?
Yeah, I think the film is really quite brilliant at setting up a division between work, the industrial workplace, and sort of what it's supposed to be a means to, you know, the perfect kind of domesticity that we get in the utopian dream sequence of the perfect house and so forth. The work in itself is, you know, there's no satisfaction. In fact, it seems to me that the film, the first part, the first reel of the film is just an absolutely brilliant visual literalization of some passages in Marx where he talks about the worker becoming an appendage of the machine. Right, and the food machine is again a quite wonderfully comically brilliant, as you say, bringing up the thing about time again. The workers don't need time, but also in just subjecting again this body to something the body needs, food, in a mechanized way. So this notion of the worker as an appendage to the machine, which is never spoken, never lectured, you know, never put in any titles, but the visualization became iconographic. Right?
The common term to refer to factory workers used to be hands. They weren't even full human beings. I mean, it's such a great comment on, you know, the ownership of the body, the disassociation from the body, et cetera.
So, in this respect, I think it's interesting that J. Edgar Hoover insisted that Chaplin was an armchair communist, I think is the term, or parlor communist. And so Chaplin was actually trying to distance himself from that kind of label because it meant that people would read his films in particular ways and in ways that would be counterproductive for all sorts of things, his career, who saw the films, etc. And also really his tramp character is sort of in some ways right inconsistent with that. I mean, the tramp is a really important central figure in 19th and early 20th century America. So there was this saying, you know, there's two people who don't work in this world, the gentleman and the tramp, you know, and Chaplin as a gentleman tramp sort of tries to combine both. But also there was another side to tramps, and that is that they did work periodically. They would go in and they would work to make a little bit of money, but they would never be owned by the boss. So they would never stay any place for very long, and they would move on. It was a point of pride that they were not slave labor, that they were not integrated into the system. So in a way, when he leaves at the end, that's what the tramp does. The tramp does not stay any place too long. He can't, if you will, if he had suddenly, you know, joined a union and become a good lefty or something. I mean, this would have been totally inconsistent with his persona work.
I just want to add very quickly that one of the things that was commented on by some critics and intellectuals of the period, however, was that this time the tramp goes down the road at the end, which is a very typical Chaplin ending, going back 20, 25 years. But now he's with somebody.
It's noted as different, but, you know, I don't know. The resolution in romance is hugely problematic, I think. So what's the you know, that image at the
it's
end.
It's worked for me.
Okay, well, it's worked. In some way, it's worked for me, too, I guess, but I don't know. I just find it troubling that I do understand, you know, that it's more positive or whatever, more hopeful, gives a kind of hope than other possible endings. It's, you know, less bleak than being alone. But I also don't think that the answer to the problems of working class enslavement, essentially, is, well, you know, go home and find romance. I think it's just a displacement, you know.
Right, right,
it's
Maureen,
just like going somewhere else.
Right, Maureen, but they don't go home and find romance.
That's right, they go out somewhere else.
And in a certain way, the sort of displaced utopia of having a perfect life and that dream, you know, kind of lives on precisely because they don't give each other up. Yeah. Now, that's not a communist utopia. That's not.
No.
But,
that's my problem with
but
it.
But it is a utopia. Okay, which is not present, it seems to me, when the tramp goes off alone, except as a kind of rugged individualism.
Okay, yeah. But romance is a kind of trap. I mean, I'm back to gender issues. I guess I have a
Maureen's husband is in the audience, by the way. I just want everybody to know that out in radio.
And he's fantastic. He's wonderful. But I'm still going to complain about romance. I mean, romance as a genre, I guess is what I want to say, is hugely problematic for women. That resolution is perhaps, you know, a positive resolution. I hate that word, positive. But it's a kind of hopeful resolution, but I'm not sure it's quite so hopeful when looked at from the position of gender politics. That's all.
Well, it's very interesting. Yeah. We were talking about how this issue is resolved. How do you find a way out of industrialization? King Vidor dealt with the psychological aspects of modernization and getting lost in the city, but in Our Daily Bread, he basically depicted in the 1930s a commune filled with all kinds of different people who gather in some sort of farm, basically. And the great moment at the end is that somehow all of these people who've come from various backgrounds and various levels of poverty manage to build an irrigation system that irrigates all of the fields. And it's a wonderful evocation of another form of utopian resolution to the issue of how do we deal with industrialization? Can we form communities that actually find some form of resistance?
But I don't think that modern times ends with a resolution or a happy ending. I mean, they if they are going to be together, actually, as it suggests, if they're going to get what they want, he's going to have to work. And then the question is, what are we going to do about it? And you know, one response in a way was unionization in the auto industry, and I think that people saw the connection, and I think that, you know, Hollywood on the upper echelons was also very concerned about unionization and very opposed to it, and the whole struggle around unionization in Hollywood was a very important one in the 1930s, and so. For that reason, I think it's not entirely surprising that that this film was sort of pushed aside.
And Chaplin, in fact, formed his own studio, which was not very popular among the great monarchs of the Hollywood system. Let's take one break here, and then we'll come right back with some questions to the audience. I'm Mark Levitt, and you're listening to Action Speaks, Underappreciated 20th Century Dates That Changed America. You can check out our show's archive on our website, actionspeaksradio.org. And there you can also find an essay written by Charles Musser, who's on our panel today. You can also listen to an interview with film historian John Bengstrom, who traces the scenes in Chaplin's films to the locations where they were actually filmed. That's www.actionspeaksradio.org. Hi, and welcome back. I'm Mark Levitt, and today on Action Speaks, we're looking at Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, the world of the assembly line against the backdrop of the Great Depression. Our guests today are Charlie Musser, professor of film and American studies at Yale University, and the author of The Emergence of Cinema, The American Screen to 1907. Maureen Reddy, chair of the English department of Rhode Island College, and the author of Traces, Codes, and Clues, Reading Race in Crime Fiction, and Philip Rosen, professor of modern culture and media at Brown University. His most recent book is Change Mummified Cinema Historicity Theory. We have a question from our audience. Name and where you're from.
I'm Paul from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. In the movie, clearly unemployment is extremely high. The father of Chaplin's love interest in the movie is beyond desperation. He can't feed his family, can't find a job. A small stolen bunch of bananas is greeted with excitement that they have something to eat. Yet at the factory, as has already been pointed out, the factory manager continues to turn up the speed, try to get more production out of the people, and the feeding machines that would theoretically allow people to work without even a break to eat. And look at where we are today with unemployment high once again. Yet if you look at some of the leading economic indicators, one of the indicators that is a positive indicator is that efficiency is at an all-time high, which doesn't always necessarily mean that we found better and more efficient ways to do things. We push people harder to try to do more, produce more with less workers. So it's, you know, quite a not very good parallel between the movie and today.
How can we look at the way in which this movie either foreshadowed or didn't our contemporary situation? Do we still live in the modern times, or are we in, quote, postmodern times where the, quote, enemies are much more diffuse, or are certain parts of the world still within an industrial culture and we are sort of post-industrial living in the remains of a factory world?
Yes.
yeah. The one moment in this film that reminds me most of our own times is the the one unmitigated success that the Chaplin character has while working, which is when he's hired as a singing waiter. He's terrible at waiting tables, but he's a huge success at singing and dancing. I don't know if people remember that scene.
So service economy is a big...
That, no, it's not just service economy, but it's also the idea of entertainment, diversion, et cetera. And on the one hand, it's the one scene where he really owns himself in the context of work. And yet, on the other, it's also, I think, a powerfully moving and sad scene in a lot of ways.
I think there's two differences between today and the 1930s, and I think it's important to think about them because they're up for grabs, if you will. And those two things are unemployment insurance, which did not exist in the 1930s, and the other is Social Security. These are, and so that's one of the big differences. That's why what we see there looks a little different than what we are experiencing now. But, you know, losing your house, I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, they're homeless. She's homeless after her father is killed. That is happening these days, that people, you know, end up sleeping in their cars or, you know, sleeping in the basements of churches or whatever.
But the physical location... Oh, I'm sorry, Philip, go ahead.
It seems to me that what's still at stake is labor. And this has to do, actually, about the... sort of the softening of the distinction between work and leisure or work and entertainment. And it seems to me the emblem of that is the computer, which is now a home machine on which we play games and we stay in contact with loved ones. But even as we play games, not only are we being surveilled for reasons of demographics, commodification, and so forth, but also then we can work at home. And in fact, many people who are employed are now working more hours than, you know, the great union goal of the industrial era was first the 10-hour day and then the 8-hour day, the 40-hour week. And it seems to me that in a lot of economic sectors, that's been blasted away.
Another question from the audience, name and where you're from, please.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska. So the film is a satire of industrial technology, but industrial technology is pretty transparent and its effects on the body are kind of obvious. So you could look at the body as a kind of mechanical thing that works a certain way and the industry is a different kind of thing or the factory is, and you could see where they line up and don't. And that could be really visual and funny. But now we have digital technology, so it's less visual, it's less hard, or it's less... it's more difficult to make those differences visible. So how could you make a satire of digital technology today?
Filmmakers, who wants to start? Charlie?
You know, I think we can over-exaggerate the digital in a kind of immediate way. I mean, I was at the grocery store this morning briefly, and, you know, there's the woman at the checkout counter, you know, and her gestures, in fact, are not that different from Chaplin's gestures in modern times. I mean, they're very repetitive. You know, they go by the scanner again and again. That's all she does for 8 hours. So maybe the more things change, the more they stay the same for many people. And I think that actually, if we're talking about working class people, you know, the service economy is of that kind is one that's grown tremendously. You know, the people who are sitting in front of their computers all day, a lot of those people are doing some kind of intellectual work that gives them actually the freedom to move back and forth between these two modes, you know. And a lot of people, in fact, don't have those choices. And I think those are the people that Chaplin was speaking to back then, and I think it's what he speaks to now.
Yeah, and I think that that's underscored in our own time as well as in the film by the... I guess, omnipresence of the police in the lives of the character in the film and I think in the lives of poor people today. The poorer you are, the more and more hostile contact you are going to have with police. And the film is very clear on that.
Yeah, I think one thing to say is that film today is filled with images and often interrogations of surveillance. And there's all sorts of very, very interesting work being done on visibility in an age, I don't know if it's necessarily a digital age, but an age of omnipresent surveillance. Yeah, go.
No. And willful surveillance through Facebook and through filling out forms and to signing up for different catalogs online so that you basically have your whole life, instead of being stopped just in the bathroom from smoking a cigarette, you're basically being looked at in your entirety of your life and seen as something that you attach consumer goods to. Another question from the audience.
My name is Vera and I live in Southern Rhode Island, and I have a comment about the control of Charlie Chaplin. I was fascinated. I just watched the movie, how much control he had over everything, like the machine that he had, the feeding machine. He was the one who operated it. But in the movie, like, he's the one who is completely out of control and doesn't have any control over anything that's happening to him. But my question is about the movie The Artist that recently... many people in the audience saw probably, and I was curious how much this movie has to be thanked to the modern times, how much inspiration came directly from this Charlie Chaplin movie.
Yeah, you know, there were a lot of films made at the in the early late silent early sound period, when a transitional period, which are like modern times in the sense that they have synchronized music and sometimes some synchronized sound effects. I do think that the director of The Artist has studied a lot of silent films and a lot of films from this period.
This film is a wonderful example of the way in which cinema or art can hold contradictions, though. Here he is refusing sound, really, from the time it was introduced in 27, really until this particular moment. Chaplin decides finally to put sound in, and yet he does it reluctantly, and you don't really hear his voice in any coherent way. You hear it in that wonderful scene where he kind of brings the audience right to the point where he's going to let them hear his voice, and then he sings a gibberish song. Mm-hmm. And sort of the wonderful thing about this film is that it's sort of betwixt and between a lot of things, like his tramp character who is neither Victorian nor industrial and not quite able to exist in any particular time and place. And in a lot of ways, Chaplin is wonderful in his depiction of the fact that you can live in that moment, however uncomfortable it actually is. Oh, we have a question from the audience. And
I just wanted to, we've been talking about the film as an American film, basically. I just wonder if we could address perhaps the internationalism of Chaplin, that, you know, my mother was working class, Liverpool manual worker, you know, really, you know, found Chaplin very hilarious. I've noticed, you know, I teach film and students, you know, from particularly countries that perhaps have sweatshops, Vietnamese student find him, you know, particularly hilarious. So I was just wondering, can we connect, you know, slapstick, you know, is slapstick humor, you know, physical humor is, you know, has an international appeal. But is there something, you know, about Chaplin in terms of appealing to now, you know, a global working class?
By the way, on behalf of the United States, I'd like to thank you for bringing and allowing Charlie Chaplin to come to our country and start a film. Yes, please.
Well, in some ways, that's a very big, you know, that's a huge question. That, you know, that Chaplin's biography, he had a very, very tough childhood, essentially raised by a single mother who was sometimes in an insane asylum. So he comes from the streets of late Victorian or Edwardian London slums.
Maureen?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it also is comedy. That is that, at least in my opinion, all really good comedy is transgressive. And there's something very attractive to, you know, a working class sensibility about that transgression.
I just want to comment a little bit and start a discussion about the transgression that Maureen was talking about that exists in modern times, and talk about the way in which artists in general reacted to the beginnings of mechanization and automation. In modern times, there's all kinds of ways, from the point of where he starts taking an oil can and spraying it into the eyes of the owner of the shop or the police, or other times where even the stealing of bananas is valorized, or you know, other moments where all of a sudden he takes over, that the passion that's inside him breaks through the discipline that's trying to take him and put him into a certain kind of constraint. That's his form, seems to be Chaplin's form of saying no, quote, to the industrial society. How did other artists deal with that? The artists, the futurists, seem to like the fact that we were moving into a society of mechanization. How else have artists, and how did the artists deal with the Depression? A contemporary, of course, would have been Diego Rivera and his murals at that time, who also visited Ford at the same time, and who actually depicted the workers' plight in a very different kind of way. Charlie?
A lot of sort of more obvious left-wing literature and film would be about characters coming to consciousness in some way and realizing their plight and joining the revolution. I mean, that was like a Soviet trope, if you will. And this is a film that certainly refuses that. In some ways, it's not wearing its politics on its sleeve, although, you know, that I'm not sure that always fooled people who were, you know, looking to see it in that light, from both right and left.
Maureen?
Popular art is often not valued as highly until its moment has gone by, perhaps. And in the 19th century, sorry to harp on this, but the mass art form that was young women were warned against and so on was the novel. The novel was where this kind of critique, et cetera, was located. And we tend now to think of, for example, Charles Dickens as, you know, high art. But in his own time, he was really interested in reaching working class people and, in fact, did. But it's through popular art that ideas spread, it seems to me. And in that way, I see a real connection between, you know, 19th century forms, film, whatever we're on now.
There's a great quote, one of the most famous quotes in the history of the New Left in 1963 by Mario Savio, who completely captures in a way the way in which the machine became the metaphor for control. He says, there's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. It seems that's Charlie Chaplin in modern times. What happened with him, with Charlie Chaplin, taking this kind of transgressive idea, this sort of support for the individual versus the machine, this way in which he was identifying with those who are betwixt and between? What happened to Charlie Chaplin?
He eventually fled the United States, making sure that he had access to all of his bank accounts first.
Was he allowed back in, Charlie or Phil?
He didn't come back then until they gave him a special Academy Award in the 70s, right?
Right. He got an honorary Oscar, and he came back. That was the one time he came back to the United States. So he could have come back in theory. I mean, but he would have had he knew that he was going to be interrogated and deemed worthy or unworthy to be allowed entry back into the United States because he was not a U.S. citizen, and that was, I think, one of many reasons why he became this kind of figure of abject for you know, among others, J. Edgar Hoover. But you know, in the terms of the Red Scare, you know, he was seen, you know, at least as a fellow traveler.
Back, section 5, more speed, 4-7.
Today we've been speaking about the 1936 release of Modern Times, the film where Chaplin lost the tramp, found his voice, and spoke for all who were disillusioned with modern times. Our panelists tonight have been Charles Musser, professor of film and American studies at Yale University, and the author of The Emergence of Cinema, The American Screen to 1907. Maureen Reddy, chair of the English department of Rhode Island College and the author of Traces, Codes, and Clues, Reading Race in Crime Fiction, and Phil Rosen, professor of modern culture Culture and Media at Brown University. His most recent book is Change Mummified Cinema, Historicity, and Theory. You've been listening to Action Speaks, produced at AS220, funded in part by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, and the law firm of Robinson & Cole, LLP. Our presenting radio station is WGBH Boston. We thank as well our media partners, the Providence Phoenix and Rhode Island PBS. Thanks as well to my co-executive producer, Bert Krenka, our managing producer, Natalie Jablonski, our senior radio producer, James Moses, webmaster and photographer, Vera Levitt, our house manager, Marilee Armstrong, and our production managers, Zach Drummond and Jacob Nathan. I'm Mark Levitt, wishing you health, happiness, and as much surprise as you need, and a little more than you think you can handle. Thank you.